drop some kind of substance and just go with the flow.
I'm not saying one ripped off the other, but I'm saying they're pretty close.
Only on copious amounts of some drug to allow you to truly enjoy what you're going to ride.
I know you're obsessed, but we'll get there.
Well, if they do that, they'll take it over, and then I'll lose my job.
Hello, and welcome to Movie
Smash!
Hello, and welcome to Movie Smash, the show where we dive headfirst into comic book movies outside the MCU. If you're new to the show, thanks for joining us. If you've been here before, you know the drill. Each episode, we're going to smash through a movie whose source material is from a graphic novel or a comic. Is it worth revisiting? Should it be forgotten? Let's find out. This is Movie Smash. I'm one of your hosts, Chris Roberts. I'm the founder of Off Panel Creations. With me today, I have Fergal Amayo.
I am Fergal Amayo, founder and owner of Gotham Knight Comics, where nerds unite and get together and do all that fun stuff. Also, resident cemetery man. While I am not talking to death, I feel like we might have a dialogue if we did have a conversation.
Yeah, you sound like you got the voice for it. And our guest host today is James Babbo.
It's great to be here. Thanks for asking me to come on. I am a comic book writer in New York and colorist. I have a bunch of books that I've been independently publishing. One called, it's a World War II series called The Moses Militia, about a group of Jewish partisans fighting the Nazi menace.
That's cool.
I have a superhero book called Golden Girl of the Party, about a group of sidekicks who started a security service to handle the dangers that no one else can. But more appropriately for this podcast, I have a book called Stan Douglas, The Punchliner, which is a horror comedy book. It's my homage to one of my favorite TV shows, 1970s, Kolchak the Night Stalker, where the premise is, what if Kolchak were a stand-up comedian who kept running into the supernatural when he went on the road?
Yeah, and you and I had the opportunity to meet each other at the Baltimore Comic-Con.
Yeah.
I think I saw one of your comics was it The Baby That Fell from Outer Space?
Yeah, that's my all ages book.
And was it Falls from Outer Space? An alien that falls from outer space and has to fight H.P. Lovecraft-style demons and monsters.
Yes.
Is that The Baby That Fell from Space? Because I saw that cover. That was a pretty cool cover.
No, thank you.
So this is our second Halloween episode. So for our movie this evening is 1994 Cemetery Man, starring Rupert Everett, Francesco, I am not going to be able to pronounce that last name, and Anna Falchi, directed by Michele Savio, who my Italian is terrible. I mean, my Japanese is fantastic. My Italian names are horrendous.
You claim they come to life within 7 days of burial.
Nagi! They came back sooner than we thought!
He's only eating me!
Move aside.
Mind your business!
This is my business. They pay me for it.
Come 3 times already.
Twice. Third one was faked. Get down or I'll shoot.
You can't. I'm the mayor.
X.
Cemetery Man.
Were you guys familiar with the comic strip that this is based off? I think it was called Dylan Dog.
Not at all. Not at all. Not, I mean, there's, you know, I pride myself in knowing a lot about a lot of books, even so much as, you know, Gru and other characters, but this one sort of, I when I went back and dug into it, there are a lot of books, because there are so many comics and there are so many indie creators. This is just, and while this wasn't really an indie creator, this was more of a European comic. I don't know, you know, I didn't see it in any of my bookstores when I was growing up. I went to some very large comic stores and it just wasn't in shelf, but whoa. That's all I can say. I read about it. It's an interesting storyline.
Yeah, this is one of those books that is apparently very famous in Europe. In Italy, they call their comics fumetti. It took me a while to piece together the connection of Cemetery Man to Dylan Dog. And I finally got it, that the creator, Tiziano...
Sclavi.
Sclavi, that's
Tiziano Sclavi. Italian. Look at that. That was awesome.
He wrote this novel before he did Dylan Dog, and it just sat on the shelf. And Michele Savio, the director, contacted him about doing a Dylan Dog movie. And apparently the rights were tied up somewhere else. But he says, hey, I have this novel which features a prototype of the character called Francesco della Morte. So there's a lot of things from that character that went into Dylan Dog So that's what they did. They incorporated a lot of things from Dylan Dog into De La Morte De La Mori, like, for example, the kind of gun that he uses and the fact that he looks like Rupert Everett.
Yeah, the actual main character of the comic strip was designed to look like Rupert. Completely unrelated. He didn't know the guy. He just liked him from various movies he had done.
And yet, Brandon Routh played him in the Dylan Dog movie.
Yeah, well, that's the reason why he requested, with this movie being made, that Rupert would play the part. I had never read this book either. I looked for it. You're right. It's huge in Europe. It was their longest running comic strip in Italy at the time.
Apparently from 1986. I actually downloaded, you can't see it on the screen behind me, but I downloaded the first 50 issues, but it's all in Italian, so I have no idea what's going on, but it's got a lot of nudity, as the movie does, a lot of zombies, a lot of shooting. It's pretty much what the movie is. And the other thing was, because I couldn't get it in time to get a collection of it, I picked up the only thing that my local comic store had. Apparently there was a Batman Dylan Dog team up.
Now look at that. Now that just tells you. So what that tells you is that DC's gone international, because again, to James's point, this is actually one of the most famous books in Italy. And this guy has created over 300 issues, very long time running. Well, he's almost a beloved character. He's a beloved creator in Italy.
Yeah, from what my research showed me was that in Italy, it actually felt more like how the Archie comics are for us. Like they're in grocery stores. Mm-hmm. This is what the Dylan Dog was like. It was everywhere. It was so prevalent. You'll be in a checkout line. There'll be a small copy of it. But so for me, obviously, I've never read the book. But was this your first viewing of this movie?
Yes. I'm just going to stop right there. let's just leave it at that. Yes, it was my first.
I saw this when it was released. I remember reading a review somewhere. It was probably in Fangoria or one of those magazines. Anything that was European-related horror, me and my friends would go and see it. And I remember it wasn't well attended. It only had a very brief run in theaters. As I was saying earlier, I got this confused with Brain Dead, Dead Alive, the Peter Jackson film, because they both came out in the same year. So I had melded these two in my head. And it wasn't until I recently picked up the Severin release of the Blu-ray, which was sitting on my shelf, coincidentally, when you guys contacted me about doing this film, that I opened it up this weekend and started watching it and all the extra features. I don't know if you guys have the Blu-ray.
I'm the guy that only buys the collector's editions. I was looking at buying it, but it's like a $50 DVD right now.
Oh, I must have got a really good deal on it.
Well, I think now because it's out of print again.
Oh, okay.
So I had not seen this movie when it came to theaters. This thing completely went under my radar. And I was trying to figure out why. Like, I had never even heard of this movie. And even movies I've never seen, at least I've heard of at some point. It was released in less than 10 theaters nationwide in the United States. So unless you happen to be in one of those markets they happen to release this, which obviously it sounds like you were, James, you would have never heard this movie.
James is in New York, and New York is the cultural center of the world. So all amazing things happen in New York.
I'm sorry, Reston, Virginia, we're the pinnacle of culture. And
well, I'm gonna bust y'all out and say Detroit's having a comeback year. So I think we might not be culture, but we got Coney.
So Fergal, do you want to give us a little sort of background, a little bit of history on this comic, Dylan Dog?
As I mentioned, and again, I'm probably going to slaughter his name, and I'm going to take the time to write this, to say this guy's name, Tiziano Sclavi. Again, you know, not a comic that I was familiar with, but he is a treasure in Italy. He has achieved 300 issues of Dylan Dog. He's been involved in other books. He's written this as was so eloquently said by James. He's also a novel. This guy's worked with major Italian artists, Claudio Villa, Corrado Rio, Gustavo Trigo. Again, I'm going to just get my Italian going on and start saying spaghetti, marinara, all kinds of stuff. This guy's got a thing, man. He's well known. He's like a legend. So I leave it there and let the story sit for itself.
See, I'm enjoying you butchering the names this time instead of myself.
I don't butcher because I'm named Fergal.
So if this is your first time joining, it's just a quick heads up. We're going to be discussing this plot of this 30-year-old movie. And with that, discuss some elements of the story you might be considered spoilers, so consider yourself warned. So, James, do you have a quick synopsis of us? Like, what actually happens in this movie?
Yes. De La Morte De La Mori, a.k.a. Cemetery Man, which is, in my opinion, a very awful U.S. title. It's a 1994 horror farce based on the novel by Tiziano Sclavi, featuring a character, Francesco Della Morte, who became the prototype for his comic book creation, Dylan Dog. In the film, he's a cemetery caretaker whose duties include killing the dead, who, for reasons unknown, return after 7 days of death. But Francesco finds himself in an existential bubble where events make him question whether the world really exists outside the gates of his occupation.
Either you wrote that, James, or that was directly pulled from the exact site of where it came from.
I've watched this 4 times. I listened to the commentary. I listened to the interviews. I was waking up in the middle of the night with ideas for this podcast, and I was keeping a notebook next to my bed. I was like, wow. Oh, I better write this down.
We have started to excite people. We have excited people. James is excited. I'm loving this. Let's take it through it. Because I was all effed up in this. This is the first time I saw it today. I've been effed. Again, just as I can say on the podcast, it's been a very busy time in my life. Lots of things going on. So I decided to take this during my Monday because it's admin day at my work. I was like, I could have this going on the TV. I'm good at multitasking. This was not a movie to multitask on.
No, that really sounded like the back of the box kind of discussion of what happened in this movie. That was really good. I enjoyed that. So one thing about this movie, it is Italian, and Italian films, just in general, films that are not U.S.-based have a different sort of feel to them, and I think this focuses more upon the characters than it actually does the plot of the movie. In fact, the plot we'll get into a little bit is very disjointed. So let's talk a little about the characters and who these people are. Francesco's our lead.
I think Rupert Everett took a lot of acid and played this character. It was like, if I'm going to do this, I think he was the first Heath Ledger. That's all I can say. I think he went in. And so I'm going to just, because he worked with Naki. So at the end of the day, you got to take some acid to work with Naki. And then he was dealing with She, which was all throughout the whole scenario. So I think he took a lot of acid just saying, I'm going to enjoy this. And that's exactly what he did. Because I'm kind of like, it was a lot of scenes and he really got into it a lot. And wow. Yeah, that's all I can say on it. James, I'll turn the mic over to you, sir.
I think you hit it on the head because there's an interview with him on this Blu-ray where he raves about this. He loves this. He says this is one of the most fun things he's ever done. And he's recognized for it when he's in Europe. I really didn't know anything about this guy. I know he's a well-known actor, but in looking at his filmography, like he's been nominated for the BAFTA, the UK version of the Oscars. The same year that he did this, he did The Madness of King George. So he was this well-known, respected guy. And he said the reason he did the film was he just loved the script. He thought he could really stretch himself as an actor. But apparently, the director says in the commentary, he didn't let him know that the character of Dylan Dog is based on him until after he signed the contract because he thought he would ask for more money. If you look at any pages from Dylan Dog from the European comic, the Italian comic, it looks like Rupert Everett. Straight up.
That's who he designed it after. That's literally the face he wanted. You're right. Rupert, before this, was a drama actor. Mainly did drama, romance. This was outside his wheelhouse. In fact, I don't think he's ever done horror after this. Like, this is the only time. I think I saw the same interview you saw as well. And he talks about it. He loves it. He talks highly about this movie and all the players in it. But it's interesting that they pulled this dramatic actor into it. And he plays it deadpan. I mean, he takes this role seriously. And what's funny is the humor he uses is it's a combination of dark humor and dad humor. Like there's a scene where he's driving the car and he goes, I know every bump in this road. And he literally drives over a rock and he goes, that was a bump. Like, and I'm like, I have made that joke to my kids.
I don't know about you guys, but it kind of reminded me of the way that Jeff Bridges played the dude in The Big Lebowski, like so laid back, like yes. Nothing really fazed him in this film.
Well, no, not when he was committing murder. Well, no,
I have written down Lebowski plus American Psycho.
It's a good combination.
Because that's what it feels like. Like, you're not sure if it's all real or not. He doesn't know if it's all real or not, but he is super laid back about this world falling apart around him.
Exactly, yeah.
Fergal, you look like you're speechless.
I'm reabsorbing what I saw earlier today. So I'm just trying to go on some of the premises. The dead rising, the folks coming up, shooting him, Naki, who only says nah, you know, and the guy who just doesn't seem to have appetite control. And just the whole thing. And I'm trying to, go back to, I'm looking at this thing, I'm like, what? Again, I just got to say out loud, what the hell was I seeing?
So he plays the part of the guardian. His job is that he works in the cemetery, and the dead come back to life after 7 days due to actually the there's a plant, the mongroove or something like that, that brings them back to life. It's not actually said in the movie, but the director says that in a later interview. That's why you see the plant zooming in with a thing crawling through. So this plant brings everyone back to life after 7 days, and the only way to kill the person is a shot to the head or a shovel to the head, depending on what they might have. In fact, there's a scene where they're sharpening the edge of a shovel to make a spade to make sure it can cut through somebody.
That's our good friend Naki.
Yeah, Naki. We'll get more into Naki in a bit. It starts off with a scene where he's on the phone with his friend, and the dead comes to his door. He realizes the person is dead, and just shoots him, and goes back to his phone call. And that really sums up the tone of the entire movie. Like, this is just another day of his life. This is my job. Like, I don't care.
Yes.
The widget comes down the assembly line. I assemble it. It goes down the assembly line. The dead wake up after 7 days. I shoot them in the head. They go back to being dead. Like, that is what I do for a living.
I would not say guardian as much as engineer, because every single person who came to that cemetery called them an engineer.
Well, he was called a guard. He calls himself a guardian.
Yes.
But everyone calls him the engineer. And actually, I have a question for you guys. Is there any reason why people are focused on calling it, or is that just a bad translation?
I mean, I delved a lot into this and tried to make sense of it. But the engineer part, I just didn't get at all.
It reminds me of like people who are janitors calling themselves sanitation engineers. That's the only connection I can possibly make with it.
If you think about it, Donnie Darko, these movies that we're kind of, because this movie falls into, there's a movie about a talking typewriter. There's a couple other movies that are like this. This movie deconstructs. So it's the whole purpose of this movie, and I think James and Chris, you guys would agree, it's a deconstruction. That's why we say farce, but it is much more than that. And I think that's where they call him. He's deconstructing the dead people. They're dead, and he's deconstructing them again. Or he's rebuilding and making sure they stay dead. And so that's why I think they view that engineer. At least that's how I thought they did it.
I don't know how far you want to get into this, but or jump ahead. There's the conversations he has with death. I think he's in some kind of inner monologue with himself. I don't think he really understands what's happening around him, if he thinks reality is real or if it's all in his head. Because it talking with death seems to make him go down certain paths, where the first half of the film is this ridiculous zombie film, and then the second half of the film, like you said, it becomes American Psycho. To me, it becomes even more frightening because he starts killing people and burning them alive.
And nobody seems to think it's him.
Yeah.
Or it's more that everyone's covering up for him, where they just don't realize what he's doing. Because there are certain scenes where it feels like the police are covering up for him. And other scenes where they just don't realize it could possibly be him. Like, you're not sure, is it a major cover-up and they know he is this hidden guardian of the undead, or they just don't care because it's so corrupt.
That chick's tits were absolutely phenomenal.
Hey, you're jumping ahead, Fergal. We haven't gotten that character yet. I know you're obsessed, but we'll get there.
Or he's so well known in that town with all the rumors that either people think about him or that he spreads himself, that they can't possibly conceive that he would do this, the things that he's responsible for.
Oh, he's impotent. And that of course, means he can't do anything wrong.
But he didn't seem to be impotent by the second scene of the movie. Like, I mean, that's what he took the big shot. But I mean, that's why I think this whole thing is in his head. I think the entire movie is in his head, because I mean, there's this, it's just crazy.
Well, I think the last shot of the movie really gives away that it's not reality. And we'll get to that in a bit. So Fergal, since I know you're waiting to get to this, let's talk about the character She.
Perfect titties. Can I just say that? Am I allowed to say that on a podcast? Perfect titties.
Well, you say that every episode, so. She plays, actually, it's funny how the character is called She. She has no name.
She does not.
And she actually plays three different roles.
Yes.
Because she keeps coming back from the dead, effectively.
Well, is that what she's coming back to? Because what I read into it was that she was playing different facets of his inability to connect with a female. And I think that may have done something to do with this, because you guys talked about his reputation in the town. Maybe that was someone that, he lost in his own mind, and that he's re-representing to represent three sides of his personality.
I think it's more about, it's supposed to be the story, it's love, because the original title is Of Love and of Death, right? So I think this is the love portion of it, that love knows no bounds, and he has fallen in love, because Okay, let's back up so the listeners know what we're talking about, because they're probably not going to go watch this movie. I have a feeling based on our review, many won't. Backing up again. So at first she plays the widow of one of the people who are being buried. And the person who's being buried is this elderly man who is in his 70s, if I did the math properly. So he then seduces her over the course of basically 2 weeks since her husband's death. From there, he falls in love with this creature who she is. And then she dies. And then she comes back as another character, as the secretary of the mayor, the new mayor after the first mayor is now dead, falls in love with her again. But then she dumps him. We'll get into that scene in a little bit. That's a little problematic about why she dumps him. And then she comes back again as a prostitute that he falls in love for again. But every time she herself says she loves him. Like something within her history is pulling back, saying that I love you as well. And Fergal, just so you know, and I had this little fact just for you. In 2009, it's the website Shot in the Head showed the top 10 boobs in horror movies, and she got number one. So I hope.
There's just no doubt. I mean, when we're in today's fake age, those were the. I stopped on that one, left that one out of my team meeting with my boss. I let that still image be the thing in my background as I was doing a team meeting, because my boss makes me irritable and that doesn't. So I just kind of, that was nice.
She was the thing that I remembered most about this film. Like, in the way that I got this confused with Peter Jackson's film, she is what stuck in my brain when I thought about this film and I bought the Blu-ray. She's unforgettable, absolutely unforgettable.
Well, her portrayal is very sort of like eerie, the way she carries herself, sort of ethereal. Yes. So yes, Fergal, she gets naked. But on top of that, she does a really good job portraying this strange being. Like, I was wondering, like, is she a witch? Should she like a supernatural being that just keeps coming back and tormenting him? Is this like a hell for this guy that somehow she is his tormentor? I don't know. But because she keeps coming back and she
this
feels
was
it.
Jacob's, this was Italian Jacob's Ladder. That's what this was. This was Italian Jacob's Ladder. If you just break everything down and you look at it, because the scenes were so disjointed and everything was so out of place and it didn't sort of sink in until the last scene. And I'll say that's the brilliance of the director, because everything was out of place. It was not. And then it just sinks in. I think that's where I think this was complete Jacob's Ladder. I think this was all. And I think she just wasn't. None of this stuff was happening in reality. It just feels like none of it was.
There's these little clues that are dropped from here to there, which are never really explored all the way through. Like, for example, as the secretary, the second character that she plays, the secretary to the mayor, she does tell him, I feel like I've been here before.
That's right.
I feel like I've been living through this before, that I know you. So it seems to me that it's a missed opportunity that they should explain why the same woman keeps reappearing in his life. Like, maybe he had a connection to her prior to the events of this film. Like something in his past, somebody that he met that he had some kind of interaction with that he did wrong, and now she keeps coming back to torment him. I don't know. He just keeps showing up.
I think
up.
We're going to get more later on about sort of our theories on what this movie's about, but it really does feel like his personal hell. But not hell the way you think of hell, in the sense of like demons, fire, brimstone, but more like he is bored with everything except for this one obsession of his, which he can't have.
Do you think it's boredom as much as it's just a slow descent into a bit of madness?
Well, it starts going madness after he gets bitten. I think early on, it's really about like it's day to day. I mean, there's a scene with him where, and we're going to talk about scenes in a bit too, but there's a scene where he's sitting there on the phone, hanging out with Nagi, just shooting guys through the window as if there's nothing else going on.
That's the Italian Boy Scout massacre. They came to dinner.
But let's before we get into sort of the plot and the sort of some of the scenes in this, there's one of the characters you mentioned, Fergal, Nagi.
Says nah.
Nagi.
That's what it says. Nah.
Except for the very end of the movie.
Can we go home?
Can we go home now?
I ruined it all for everyone. Yes, that's what he says at the end of the movie.
What did you think of the character Nagi?
He's probably the most interesting dude in there. I think Nagi had a whole backstory. I could create a comic on Nagi alone. I really believe there's a backstory to Nagi. I think you just got to get into Nagi's head and figure out where he came from. What's his motivation?
The guy who plays Nagi is supposedly a huge French actor who's also an opera singer. He's a writer.
Yep.
So he's like this. So the fact that he's this huge star in France and he has one line this whole movie, but he does portray a lot of emotion through that one line of nah, which reminds me of Game of Thrones Hodor type of character.
I didn't I didn't see Game of Thrones.
Well, Game of Thrones, there's a character called Hodor, and that's all he says. He's this giant of a guy, huge, bulking dude that eats a lot. And he just says Hodor, and he kind of protects the youngest Stark son. And the reason he says it is because he gets hit in the head by a door. And he's told to hold the door. And that's why he keeps saying Hodor. Nagi, who is relieved of his ability to speak, he gets it back, but he gets hit in the head. And now he can speak again. I'm not saying one ripped off the other, but I'm saying they're pretty close.
Nagi is just, he's a great mime. He's one of these guys that he steals every scene that he's in just by his facial expressions, the things that he does, his movements. I don't want to jump ahead for his big scene, but.
Well, why don't we do that? Let's jump ahead to the scenes. I sit there and I'm taking my notes during the movie and I'm saying like this scene might be interesting to talk about. I was basically writing out the script. Like essentially every scene, I was like, there is something either really neat or really wrong about this scene. Let's put it on the sheet.
That's because it was disturbing. It was one of the, I just want to reiterate for the crowd. If you attempt to do something else while watching this movie, you do so at your own peril.
there are many movies we have reviewed and discussed. You can put it on the background. You will not miss a thing. This, you will miss it because most things are sight gags or just you have to be paying attention or you're going to miss that little thing that's happening behind it. So this movie's full of disturbing scenes. What scene stuck out to you the most?
I would say, you know, there are a couple scenes. The scene with Death, I thought that was interesting. But I think kind of that whole, I don't know, that scene with the old man and she coming back to bite, the really, you know, I'm getting into this thing. I'm looking at boobs. I'm like, okay, we're going, okay, Rupert, we're making magic happen. And then the zombie. And then I'm just like, what the? And I'm kind of, and why, you know, why? And I'm just, that literally just, and then just the reaction afterwards. That just
I will save you a little bit, Fergal. So the scene you're talking about was very Army of Darkness to me, because there was a lot of humor in it, though is played very straight for that part of it. Like she has been seduced by Francesco, and she's decided to make love to Francesco on the grave of her deceased husband. And her rationale why it's a good idea is because they share everything. And I love how the little faceplate of the guy changes from like the stern look to like. And what I'm talking about for our listeners is there's every grave has on it a faceplate of the deceased person, and his picture changes based upon what's happening around him, which should have been a clue.
Yes.
Something is not right.
The scene that stands out to me is when Nagi throws up on the girl.
Yep.
And which is straight out of South Park, but that wouldn't happen for like another 15 years. But he then goes, he's so enraptured by this 14-year-old girl that he digs up her grave. And instead of taking her whole body because he knows she's coming back to life, he just takes the head. And he keeps the head in a TV set. And apparently they're having a love affair, and he kisses her and feeds her food. And for some reason, the head can move on its own. It follows him around.
Like a puppy.
The graveyard.
That was Evil Dead. So that was Evil Dead. I mean, that when at the end, when he went after Daddy, that was Evil Dead. I was like, what? So either Evil Dead was biting off them or they were biting off Evil Dead, because that was
funny. I think it's funny, though, that the scene that you kind of mentioned where they're at the cafe. And he's with Nagi, and Nagi throws up on the mayor's daughter. That's like the tip of the iceberg, because all of a sudden, then she's freaking out, and a guy randomly shows up on a motorcycle. She jumps on the back of the motorcycle, and she says, "You knew what I wanted," and then drives off on the motorcycle. And Francesco's telling the mayor, "We need to talk about the cemetery." And they sort of like calmly walk away. Like, this crazy scene is just unplayed in this open door, this open air cafe, and no one cares. Nobody cares.
And then then it's like Blood on the Highway. Then it's literally a Blood on the Highway episode. It's literally a PSA about don't ride a motorcycle on a mountain. I thought her head got smashed off. I don't even know where she's still around, because I was like, she's gone. I saw a blood and then a head got squashed.
They say in the film that they had to sew her head back together.
Honestly, looking at that car accident that occurs. So for our listeners, the motorcycle, eventually she goes and joins a bunch of motorcycle teenagers. And there's like, what, six or eight of them or something like that, traveling down the highway, and they take a turn too sharp, and there's a bus full of nuns and Boy Scouts who crash into them, and like somehow they hit them and they drive over them twice, and their heads split open, and then the bus like goes off the cliff, Like the accident makes no sense, but nonetheless, like that, all of a sudden now they got this big rush of dead people coming to the cemetery. And as we all know, 7 days later, they're all coming back.
That was so many dead people. So, I mean, I would be, you know, first off, as soon as I started seeing all those things, I'd be like, Nagi, let's get more bullets. I think he did say that. Nagi, we're going to need more dum-dums. And I understand that because that's what they call bullets, dum-dums. So I think they just need to have, because there were a lot of people coming down that pipeline. That was the busiest place in that entire town.
And if you don't pay attention, you don't realize that the Boy Scouts were on that bus. Because later on, when the Boy Scouts break into his place at the cemetery and he starts shooting off, killing off the Boy Scouts, like, oh yeah, that's right, they were on the bus that went off the cliff.
Yes.
Yeah, this movie does not hold your hand on anything.
It's the little things that just I just become obsessed with. Like, for all the craziness of the fact that Nagi is keeping this little girl's head in a TV set, to me, the craziest part of that whole scene is that the mayor wants to dig up the body because he thinks it'd be a good idea for a campaign ad to take a photo of his dead daughter's body to put on posters to say, look, I suffered too.
Well, now here's my question. When the so this is what threw the idea of the Jacob's Ladder scene off, because up until that point, everything was told through the point of view of Francisco de la Morte. So it was all through him and Naki's point of view, how they were viewing the world. When that mayor heard his daughter's voice and was like, is Fedorino, and he walks in and we see her, I thought for a second, is this shit really happening? Are they really, is his daughter's head really about to do business? Because, I mean, at that point, I was like, this is some great.
Flies out of the TV. I don't know how she propels herself at all. So when she crawls across the floor, flings herself across the room, kills the mayor, and the police officer's there, the chief of police. Now they've got this crime scene set up, and of course, there's a cameraman standing around, takes the picture. And yet somehow they're all still okay, and nobody knows the undead has come back to life.
Yeah, it still hasn't dawned on people when the corpus head of a person is eating on some flesh. And why are they eating flesh? Any curiosity? Because that's a Return of the Dead thing. Are they eating brains or just have a desire to eat upon flesh?
That's why the daughter's head just wants food.
Couldn't you just get a hamburger?
Well, he gave her spaghetti with like a hock of ham on it.
A lot of spaghetti.
Another unreality is when the police commissioner walks in and sees the dead mayor on the floor with his neck bitten off. He doesn't even dawn upon him that maybe Francesco or Nagi have anything to do with it.
He just assumes they're innocent.
Francesco says, well, if you take a mold of our teeth, they're not going to match the teeth marks of those bite marks. So I guess it's unsolved.
Like everything else.
Well, I don't think that detective was quite bright enough. I think the only time he might have clued in was when the car was in the down. He was like, nobody could drive that car, but I think that was the only time he actually showed any police skill whatsoever.
One of the scenes that got me was when he's first trying to seduce the widow, he's leaving with her and he's trying to say like, oh, I'm amazing, I'm a biologist, I just go to school, I own a house, you want to see it? And as she's walking around, he goes, oh, we have an ossuary. And for whatever reason, that's where she's like, oh, I love to see an ossuary. Now, I know what an ossuary is. Not everyone knows what that word means. So when they all of a sudden come and they're like, they open it up, there's like a room full of just bones. And she's just really excited.
And she was turned on. She was really happy about it. But then somehow that's where my brain flipped out. Maybe it's because it was tuning out to allow itself back into reality. But what freaked her out in the ossuary? Because she got back to the boat, she was like, ah! And then she left a frustrated Rupert.
The ossuary that they filmed in is a real ossuary. And the film crew did not know it was real. They thought it had been set up by another crew to film in. So they actually, you know, reserved this place as some cemetery inside of Italy. So those bones are real human bones on those walls. And so when they're filming, actually what ended up happening was one of the film crew took some of the bones that evening because he thought they were just props. When he found out they were actually real bones, he thought he was going to get cursed and brought them back the next day.
Well, yeah, apparently in one of the two cemeteries that they filmed in, they had to clear away an area to film to make these makeshift graves that were part of the scenes. So they had to empty out those bodies and bones for the one locale that they set up in, like, for example, the lovemaking scene on top of the tombstone.
Oh, yeah, because it was an old abandoned cemetery for the shoot.
It was a deconsecrated cemetery. And that's why they were able to move all the bones and everything.
God bless Rupert Irvin, because there would be nothing that would allow. I mean, again, I think I'm a pretty happening guy, but that would not happen at that moment. I would have to, you have to give me a Hojo because that would not be happening.
One character we sort of we didn't really touch or even bring up at all, but there's a major scene with him is his friend. We talked about him. He talks on the phone all the time, but he eventually sees his friend in the hospital, and his friend's been accused of all the murders that Francesco does.
Was that his friend? Again, the theory of this whole thing kept losing me in and out. That was his friend in the hospital?
That was his friend in the hospital, which is why it was so powerful when he says, I don't know you.
Wow. Okay.
That's the guy when he goes, because Francesco is a public servant and works for the town, he goes to this government office to pick up his wages. He has a sign for them. And the guy that he meets that gives him the wages, that's Franco, the guy that's in the hospital.
I did not know that. Now I learned something new today. This is
awesome. Now this movie should be coming together for you. That was the piece you were missing.
No, that was the piece. No, it certainly explains something that the dialogue didn't explain.
Yeah, which is why it's supposedly, and Francesco kept saying, like, I'm his only friend. And that's why it's supposed to be very powerful that when he's in that surgeon's room and he says, I don't know you, when he's under, it's supposed to tell you that there is something seriously wrong here.
At the point where the dead keep coming in and you see that scene where Francesco is just looking out the window and he's talking to Franco on the phone, actually, when that happens. So you see the dead are like swarming to his place. On the commentary, the director and the writer are saying that, you know, the book that this is based on was a series of single story chapters. So there was no arcing narrative in the novel. So they had to create one to try and tie it all together. It's there that he's saying the writer says on the commentary, there's no plot. It's all about routine, the boredom of his routine of his boredom, the routine of his life. And he's telling Franco on the phone, you know, eventually your wife is going to get tired of you and your daughter is going to hate you. So if you get rid of them, you'll be free. So I wonder if he's saying that to Franco or if he's really saying it to himself, because that's when, and after talking to Death, he goes and starts killing people randomly.
That's right.
So we didn't really talk about that Death scene, because Death tells him to save yourself the effort of killing the dead and just go kill the living.
Exactly.
So I think he's trying to pass that same message on to Franco, and then Franco's not accepting it, which is why Franco does accept it. Franco kills his family.
Yeah.
What? So wait. Franco. Okay. Yep. That's now. See, it's all starting to come together.
All these pieces are finding a place for you.
The brain is working on prior data.
You're gonna be like, this is the movie of the year when we're all said and done.
No, here. This will haunt my dreams tonight. This some scene will come into my dream tonight, whether I ask for it or not. Something will pop its way in there.
Yeah, and so at that point where, like I said, this is the second half of the film where it turns into American Psycho. Apparently the producers thought it was way too realistic and serious. So they wanted it to become more ambiguous. And that's why he starts, when he shoots, he's like going pow, pow, like he's acting like a little kid. And the whole scene turns upside down. And before he goes in his car to start shooting them, you'll notice he falls asleep. So you don't know if it's a dream sequence or not until the next day when the commissioner or the cop inspector contacts him and says, you know, we had this mass killing, but you're off the hook because we got the guy in custody. He's in a hospital.
That's right. That is right. And so that was after he had went on the complete spree down through the hooker and burned that whole house. Well,
there's two sprees. There's a spree at the cafe, and then there's he burns down the hooker, the brothel. Those are two different scenes. He shoots up the cafe with all those people, and the inspector says he couldn't have done it. They believe Nagi had done it and stolen his car. And of course, he's like, he can't drive. And the guy's like, well, I guess we don't know who it is. And they just, you know, go away. The other one is where he meets the third she, and she's a hooker, which he doesn't know, and has to pay her $250,000. I don't know if that's how expensive that is, what that translates to.
For some ass? That's a lot of dollars. That was like $100. That's a lot of dollars for ass. Excuse me. I'm sorry if I wasn't supposed to say that.
I don't know how much. I don't know what the going rate was back then. Now we're all in euros, so. Then he gets mad at her and he burns it all down, which you see as reflection in his Volkswagen Bug. And that's when he says, yeah, the other guy is our culprit.
Yeah, that was interesting.
I think another thing that is probably lost in American audiences, but would have really made a lot of an impact with Italian audiences, is the whole idea of his impotency, his able to hook up with she constantly throughout the film, and then the idea that he was going to get himself castrated.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Because the second she character says she can only be with a man who's impotent. Yeah. And all of this is in that whole Italian machismo thing where you, the hero has to be this virile guy to, you know, win the girl over. But the fact that he spreads a rumor that he's impotent so people will leave him alone, that probably had more impact on an Italian audience than it would be on us. Like, why would you do this, dude?
Well, I'm still wondering why the doctor was so close to nipping and tucking and then came out with this big-ass needle.
It's the same thing. Like, you don't do that to another guy. You don't cut off the little junior, right? Instead, I'm going to stab you with this giant syringe that'll make you impotent for 30 days. And then, of course, he meets up with she again. She goes, oh, I've changed my mind.
That was an interesting one right there. That was definitely... I would be like, look, lady, takesies, backsies, we're doing this thing.
But apparently the chemical didn't work because he was able to hook up with the prostitute like 3 times.
Yeah, she said 2. He said 3.
No, it was the other way around. Definitely... She said it was 3 times. He goes, oh, no, I faked the 3rd time.
Yeah.
That's right. So I told you this movie left some interesting indelible marks.
Also, one other thing that's interesting, they don't call them zombies. They call them returners.
Returners, yeah.
So do you have any theories as to why they do that, or do you think that's just a language thing?
I think every zombie film needs to differentiate themselves from others. You know, like The Walking Dead calls them walkers, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Yeah, and I think in The Walking Dead universe, like zombie movies never existed. But I guess there's got to be, you know, everyone's got their own take on things.
I like The Returners, though. I do think that name is a pretty, I mean, so of all the things, that was interesting because it did foreshadow. It did foreshadow some things. I think using that name kind of foreshadowed some things in the whole. I mean, it's just an interesting way of describing coming back. But they sort of dropped the ball when people stopped coming back after 7 days or come back like the next day or a day after next.
Well, it's also another thing about the fact that it only seems to be this one cemetery. You know, that it tells you that this is an isolated incident. This is an isolated bubble of Francesco's life where it's only there because Franco says, why don't you just tell the mayor that the dead are coming back to life? He goes, well, if they do that, they'll take it over and then I'll lose my job.
Which is the most important thing to him. And also, he doesn't want to fill out the form MI-72 or something, whatever the number was. He knew the form number. Like, there's a form number for saying the dead are coming back to life. And he didn't want to have to spend the time to fill it out.
But as far as the zombies go, I like the fact that, you know, like you were mentioning that, you know, he was trying to incorporate the director, the myth of the Mandrake root.
Yes.
To bring that, what was bringing these things back to life, because they all seem to have roots and vines coming out of them, which reminded me of the way the zombies looked in The Girl with All the Gifts or The Last of Us, where it was fungus based.
Yeah, that was cool. But I was trying to, you know, again, so many parts of this movie were lost on me. But that part to the root, I don't remember. When was that mentioned that the root was
the cause? They never mention it for words, but they show scenes. They show scenes where the root's cutting down, like when the deceased husband, one of the first undead we see, the camera follows the root through the ground into his coffin, and then like he's breaking at the root that's in there. And then also her, when she comes back, she looks like a tree person. Now she's got leaves coming out of her. She's got vines coming out of her. So they're trying to imply that it is this plant, which obviously only grows in this one cemetery, or it just doesn't grow in cemeteries other places.
Yeah, on the commentary, the director said he wanted to further explain that, but they just didn't have the time or the space to throw it in.
That makes sense.
And I think some of the disjointed things we're seeing about this was, as you mentioned, in the book, the book was not a plot-driven book. It was like, here's a strip, here's like a few panels, here's a quick story that happens. And I think that's why it's so disjointed. Like I was mentioning, the Archie comics, not the Archie comics, but more like a family circus where like every week it's something different, or no, Archie comics where it didn't matter what book you read there. No, it all resets to zero the next time you pick up another book. I think that's what that this happens with this story as well, is that it feels very disjointed and they try to create a plot that works within it. Cause there's no adversary. There's no foe that he's up against. It's just him.
The moment that the whole thing fell into place, because like I said, I watched this 4 times in a row. Listening to the commentary, the director, he mentions that the creation of death, the way it was put together and the way it looks, was his homage to Terry Gilliam because he worked as a second unit director on Baron Munchausen. So then it all fell into place to me, like, oh, we should be looking at this as like a fantasy Gilliam film. This is Brazil. This is Baron Munchausen. This is Time Bandits. You can't expect reality in this film, because I could see how people would get very frustrated watching this, as, you know, I could see with Fergal here. But once you look at it as like, it's just reality doesn't play into this. It's whatever, you just go with the flow. It's a Terry Gilliam type film. Then it all fell into place for me.
I was just surprised they got some interesting actors for this movie. They do, you know, both in Italian and American and British cinema, they got some pretty big name actors on this movie. I mean, the guy who played in Underworld, he played the kind of the source of the vampire werewolf plague. He played the devil. He was the devil. So Derek Jacobi or whatever his name was. So, I mean, Rupert Everett, you know, they got some pretty decent sized names for a movie that I had never heard of, quite frankly, that's only on Shudder, that I was like, and then right after it, I'm watching Retreat from the Sun. Like, it rolled my algorithm into the next crazy ass movie. And it was vampires trying to retire and live in the sun.
The person that played, I can't think of his name right now, but the person who played the police inspector, like, he's a very famous actor. He's been like 100 films, lots of film noir. He was blacklisted in the 50s for a short period.
That's right.
He had to go over to Europe to start doing films, but he apparently had a very huge career in Hollywood in the 40s and then the 50s before he got kicked out for a while.
And for being such an unusual story that no one has ever heard, really, just the author, the story, the illustration, just all of it, really not a big audience in America for something like this. Because as you said, 10 theaters, there have been two movies adapted from this guy's work. So, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you've got Cemetery Man and you've got Dylan Dog. And what you showed us, James, is that it's still crossing over in adaptions with DC. So, I mean, there's the interesting influence of things you can't possibly see, right? Like, it just, it's amazing. Because I'll look for that comic. I'm a huge Batman fan, sans Gotham Knight comic. So I will look for that book just now, just because I want to see how they incorporate Dylan Dog into that story.
Now, you kind of touched upon how this movie doesn't flow like a traditional story. You're right. You can't go into it thinking, I'm looking for the antagonist, I'm looking for the big villain. It's just surreal. So pacing is very important in a movie like that.
I think it was just all over the place. I don't think it was first off, it did go slow, but it went slow because you were constantly going a 10 second back going, what the fuck did I just see? And you were trying just 10 second that shit back, turn the volume up, make sure you didn't miss some critical exposition. So I was literally breaking the fourth wall every time I was looking at this movie.
This movie's 100 minutes long and Fergal spent 300 watching it.
Oh, sweet Jesus. Again, I for everyone, don't watch while you're trying to do something else.
It jumps from scene to scene, and it doesn't give you time to catch your breath, because you're like, wait a minute, what just happened? Wait a minute, what's happening now? Wait a minute, what's happening? It just keeps going at a fever pace.
You know me so well, James.
James, I think you hit on it. For me, too, I don't think it was slow, but I don't think it was fast either. Like, I was watching it, and it just felt like as soon as the scene was done, I'm trying to digest it a little bit. I'm on to the next thing. And I don't have time to digest what I just saw. But at the same time, I didn't need the time to digest what I just saw. Because no matter how much I spend on it, there's no interpreting it. It just happened. Like, there's no way to figure out how it connects as a puzzle piece, because there is no puzzle to connect together. Just enjoy the pieces landing in front of you is what the movie's about. So, like I say, pacing-wise, I can't say it was too fast or even too slow. It is. It is what it is.
There's a scene, and you mentioned it briefly, where when she comes back and looks like the best Poison Ivy cosplay I've ever seen, and they start making out, she actually bites him.
She does.
So you're not expecting that the protagonist of the film is going to get a bite taken out of him. And then later on in the movie, there's a scene where the wound is missing. And I thought, okay, they're trying to show that this is all in his head. But no, on the commentary, they say that was a continuity error. They forgot to put the wound in. But then the wound comes back when he's with the third version of She as the prostitute, and they're in bed together. You see the wound there.
Well, that's because you shouldn't do acid when you make Italian movies.
This guy's daily life is to kill zombies or the returners. He already killed her because she got bitten.
Well, he says he killed her and she wasn't a zombie.
So he thought the bite killed her because she did die. in actuality, he killed her when she wakes back up in the ossuary. But that aside, so he's going into that moment thinking, if I get bitten by her, I'm dead. But he's like, no, F it. I'm just going for it. I like Tree Lady. We're going to have some fun.
But he does mention that a bite doesn't kill you. He doesn't know for certain if he will have to die in order to come back as a zombie. But that one bite isn't going to do it. But if anything happens to him in the future and he dies, he doesn't know whether or not he's going
to
come
back.
Yeah,
and I thought that bite was what was driving him to madness. This is before I realized that there was nothing to really understand about the movie. So I thought, oh, he got bitten by this, or she's a witch because she came back. And it's like he got bitten by her. Now he has poison in his body, but it didn't kill him. So that's why he starts seeing death. That's why he starts being a little crazy. I was like, that's the story. That's the story we're thinking about here. Like, this is the driving fact. No, I'm completely wrong. He gets bitten. It gets healed. That's it. We don't even mention it again later on. But I really thought in that moment, that's what was driving this movie. Was it wasn't just like, I'm a zombie killer. It's I'm the cursed zombie killer. Like, when I die, I'm coming back and someone's got to kill me. That's where I thought the plot was going to go, because I wanted this movie completely blind.
That's a good theory.
And probably burned one of your retinas as you were watching it.
So we spoke about the effects a little bit. How do you feel the special effects were? I mean, this movie is 30 years old.
Oh, yeah. That threw me. That's part of the reason why it took me a long time. Movies that are historically done bad, right? Now, there are a few good horror movies that hold up well. Like you mentioned Evil Dead. That holds up well. Evil Dead 1, Evil Dead 2. Even though the horror is stupid and snarky, it just flows extremely well. And that goes to Sam Raimi's eye. That goes to the vision. This movie was, I think, they didn't get the best FX guy, but they did the best they had. And I think that, coupled with the 35mm shot frame, I think it just didn't hold up as well in today's, like on Shudder, it just didn't look as good. Like, it was a little hard, the volume was a little off, plus the horror was like, it was the boobs that saved the whole thing.
It's also on Tubi. Go watch it on Tubi again. You'll be fine.
I gotta watch it on Tubi.
She is
now
the best effect in the whole film.
Woo! Jesus, Lord have mercy. I might just watch the boobs again.
Like the blood in that movie, those were not real.
No. Come on. Was that early plastic surgery? Yeah, are you going to give me some DVD commentary on this right now?
There was an interview I watched for saying that when she was a kid, she was picked on for, you know, being small. So she went that route.
Don't take this from me. You just took this from me. You just took it right from me.
Well, one of the effect scenes that I really enjoyed was when, and they don't explain why they would bury somebody in a motorcycle, but when the motorcycle comes out of the grave and then picks up that girl, and then she allows him to eat her, and she tells Francesco, "Look, I can let anybody eat me that I want."
That was something.
A loaded piece of dialogue.
That scene is when you realize that they know they're not making Shakespeare.
Yeah,
no.
He comes bursting out of his tomb in a motorcycle with a helmet, and because it's all shadows at first, like it looks like the devil. But then as soon as the light gets on him, you're like, it's just his helmet. It's cut in half already. And yeah, where his head is placed when he's devouring his ex-girlfriend and she says, oh, I'm letting him eat me. You're like, they know they're just messing with us now.
Yes.
His makeup is an interesting combination of the plant theme that we've been seeing throughout the whole film. But he also has parts of the motorcycle incorporated into him. So it looks like a plant Borg human.
And who buries their kid with their full motorcycle?
When they were running through the coffins, I was like, I was waiting for an Oompa Loompa to show. Are you fine? I was like, are you serious? Are they seriously? Is not Noki going to be putting a motorcycle in the ground?
So what is your guys' theory about what this whole movie is actually about? Because we haven't mentioned it. The last shot is they're inside of a snow globe.
Wait. No, that's not actually happening. Are you, what? Come on. I rewinded that twice. They drove to the mountains. They stopped. He hit the bump. He said, "Oh, bump!" And then he stopped the car. And then he threw it. Then the luggage went over the side thing. And then he banged his head. And he's like, and then Noki said, "Can we go home?" Were they really in that snow globe? Where was the snow?
But yeah, they're in a snow globe. It starts zooming out, and it looks like they're inside of a snow globe. What's your theory on this movie? Are they in a snow globe? Is this some sort of hell that they're in? What is it all about?
My theory is that they're in their own pocket universe, Francesco and Nagi. Because all throughout the film, Francesco cannot connect with human beings. I mean, the man reads the phone book. That's the only book that he reads. and he works in a cemetery. He starts rumors about himself so people will leave him alone. His only friend is Nagi, and he doesn't understand if the world really exists. So when he goes through that tunnel, because he says, I wonder what the world is like out there. When he gets through the tunnel, the road, the highway ends, the turnpike ends. So there's nowhere to go. And so he understands that, well, they're stuck. This is where they are. They have no place to go but home. So the snow globe is just a metaphor. It's just an interpretation of the fact that they're stuck in their own private purgatory. And they're never going to break out of this. And listening to the commentary kind of confirms this, because the ending was just supposed to be a happy ending where they're leaving the town, they're going forth to whatever the challenge of the future holds for them. But the writer and the director didn't like that. They wanted to add something else, some kind of twist. And that's where they came up with the idea that the highway ends and there is no future. There is no reality. There's nothing out there. It's just them. And the snow globe was an homage to Citizen Kane with Orson Welles.
I was actually thinking that too. I was like, the only connection I could make with that was Citizen Kane, because there's a lot of homages in this movie.
Oh yeah.
But I didn't see the commentary, so all I thought was happening was that this was a type of purgatory, and essentially people get raised from the dead, they've got to go through their own hell, they got to learn some lesson that lets them leave eventually, which means they die in this purgatory, which lets them go to the next world. And because he keeps killing them as they keep coming back from the dead, he's ruining Death's plans. And that's why Death steps in and is like, dude, stop doing that. Like, you know, you're not helping me out here.
The snow globe completely, I'm lost. I can't even provide effective, wonderful commentary, except the end of the movie just left me with like questions, not answers, but I did not see the snow globe at all.
Well, Fergal, I'll help you out. Next time you go watch it, just, you can see boobs in the reflection of the snow globe. It'll draw you in.
Will there be a next time? That's the question of the day.
If I tell you there are boobs in a snow globe, will that make you watch it again?
No. I'll find her boobs and I'll stop at that point, but I'm not sure I could endure this movie for another hour and a half. I just feel like it makes my stomach a little twisty, and I'm like, holy cow, what is going on here?
Oh, I was going to make one comment, because there's an interview with her on the Blu-ray. She had a very, I don't know if anybody, if you guys agree with me, but she had a very baby-like face in this film. She looked extremely young, and she's now, I think, 52. I think she looks better now that she's grown into her looks. She looks like a mature woman, but when she first appears, to me, she looks like a, if it wasn't for that brick house body, I would think she's a young child.
Ooh. She does kind of have a teenager's face, which is why I think they probably chose her for that, just because they make it so stark that she was married to this elderly man.
And she admits that she had a cartoon-like body. She says it in an interview. I could see why they chose me, because I look like a comic book character.
I really wish I had this commentary. Normally, I spend some time going over like production things, production decisions, but obviously I didn't have too much of that. But I do have two things I want to ask you guys. So this movie's original title was
De la Morte, De la More.
Thank you. That was the original title, which means, you know, of love, of death. Changed to Cemetery Man because Americans don't understand that. But the Spanish title was translated to My Fiance is a Zombie. What's the better title of those three?
Oh, Cemetery Man, because then you're left clueless as to what the hell this movie's about. I think anything beyond that, you have to leave it as ambiguous as possible so that you can just stay lost from beginning to end, which is what you'll do.
It reminds me of what the studio wanted to call Beetlejuice. The title they wanted was House Ghost, which is just terrible. So because I'm really big into Euro horror, I had no problems with De la Morte, De la More.
I think it hits better. It really does. Now, My Fiance is a Zombie be even more confusing since he's never engaged to anybody. Oh, wait, no, he does get engaged to the second one, the second she. The other one is that when we talked about it, it was released in less than 10 theaters in the U.S., and there's a reason why. No distribution company wanted to pick this movie up. So early in the production of this movie, there was an American company saying, we will distribute this for you if the main casting for Francesco is Matt Dillon.
Really?
He wouldn't have did it. I don't think he would have did it. I think this movie confuses too many people. I think you need a European actor for a European movie. I think that's why you don't see any American actors in this movie. It's, you know, we did make our own fair share of crazy ass movies, but this movie pushes so many boundaries. I just think it doesn't work without the cast that it has.
Yeah, I don't think Matt Dillon could have pulled off the dark humor Rupert Everett did.
And of course, the writer said it was Rupert or nobody, so they passed on that, which is why it wasn't distributed anywhere in the United States, effectively.
And oddly, this was shown at a horror festival in Europe. I can't remember the name of the festival, but on the board, the jury was a who's who of horror. They had John Carpenter, Tobe Hooper, a bunch of other people, and they all gave this the best prize, the jury prize award. And the audience, they gave it the award for the audience prize at this festival. And that, I think, would have sold it. I think the fact that Martin Scorsese called this the best horror movie of the 90s, there were a lot of people that were pushing for this film. So I don't know how that didn't play into a distributor's reasoning for not releasing this film.
The budget for this movie is $4 million. The gross was $250,000.
Wow.
That says, and it's, you know, again, if you look at movies that are like this, and you mentioned, I believe it's Buried Alive, Peter Jackson's movie, and, you know, Platform, and movies that sort of fall into this kind of crazy genre, they may not have the biggest groupings, but they have pretty damn, because if you go onto Reddit pages, there's a pretty substantial and deeply loyal following to this movie that will, you know, defend it till its day gone by as one of the best pieces of black humor or dark humor, or dark horror humor, like written or put out there.
People that are into Euro horror, this fits in very well with that, because the guy, the director, Michele Soavi, he was an actor who appeared in a ton of horror films. He worked either as an actor or as a second unit director for guys like Dario Argento, Lamberto Bava, Mario Bava's son, Lucio Fulci. He worked with all the big names in horror gore. And it didn't occur to me until after I saw the interview with him that, oh, I know this guy. He was in Demons. If you've seen the Lamberto Bava film Demons from 1985, he's the guy who's wearing this metal mask who's giving out free movie passes to people in the beginning of the movie. And then they go to the movie and then they get attacked by zombies. If you guys haven't seen Demons, that is this to like times 10.
I'll put on my Halloween evening watching for trick-or-treaters.
Gosh almighty, that may lessen the amount of folks coming to your door today.
That is more candy for myself.
That was the plan all along.
What do you guys love about this movie? What could they have done better?
Well, I think the absolute absurdity of it is the thing that stands out to me. And I think, again, despite really just being like, what the fuck? I enjoyed several scenes in this movie repeatedly because I was like, what the? And again, the entire movie was breaks of typing emails, looking up, going, what the fuck? And rewinding and just slowing everything down so I could see what I just watched. So I was gracefully and demurely discussing this movie today. And despite myself, I'm always impressed when you can get multiple what the F's out of my mouth in a movie. That was good. Other than that, what the F was this movie? I'm left with more questions than answers. I'm just in a position where, as I said, this will seep into my brain somewhere, probably for like the Village People, probably for a few days it will bounce around there.
Well, it sounds like it made an impact on you.
It certainly did.
Yes. I could see how people could get easily frustrated with this, and I totally agree with everything you guys have been saying. I like the ambiguity. I like the fact that it makes you think about what's going on. It makes you come up with your own theories. Yes, I agree. It could have used maybe a little bit more explanation, a little bit more to tie all the pieces and scenes together. It's crazy, and I love crazy movies.
I actually enjoy this movie in the sense of, like, it's nuts. It's crazy, right? It is an experience. What they could have done better was going into it knowing what I'm getting into, which is why I think it's a cult film. Versus did well in the box office, because in the box office, if I were to see this and had paid the ticket price to go see this, I'd be like, what did I just pay for?
Yes.
There are many movies, especially in my college years, we would watch over and over and over again because I knew it was absurd. I knew what I was getting into, which means I could enjoy it more. And I know, James, you saw this thing four times this weekend. I can only imagine the fourth time was better than the first time, because I can tell you from experience, the first time I was like, do I like this? I'm not sure. By the end, I'm like, okay, I do like it. Now that I've been thinking about it, But I think I need to see it more times to really appreciate all the aspects of it. But I don't think I'm ready to do it again anytime soon.
I think you said, what the fuck, the first time you saw it. I think you sat in the room. Hopefully your kids didn't come in. And you were just like, what the? And you were hitting the rewind button just like I was. You were like, what the fuck? I just turned the volume up a little bit.
It's funny you say it. So I watched it on Tubi, but I did not log into Tubi because I did it on my PlayStation. I didn't log into Tubi when I did it. And Tubi, the moment you pause the movie and leave it to come back in, it forgets where you were. So I rewatched the beginning a couple times.
Yeah, that made it even better at that point.
Can we mention the Brendan Routh film?
Dylan Dog.
Have you seen that?
I have not, but I got to, you know, begin because I, after you get, so my preparation process today, as I've clearly described in this show, was, you know, okay, I'm going to pop this one in today because I feel like, you know, these last movies we've been, you know, and I've taken it for granted. We've been able to go through movies I've seen 150 times. I don't even have to watch it. I'd be like, I know every scene of this movie in my head. But this one, I had to stop. And a 100-minute movie took a little bit longer for me to get through. And then I was like, well, let me. And so I know there's a paranormal investigation. I know there's ghosts. I know he's trying to make deals and do things. So I'm going to go probably find that movie at some point. I'm going to take myself a break because I want to get a little bit of, you know, therapy on what I just watched. And then I'm going to make another venture into this guy's work.
I tried watching it. It's such a comparison. If you take the beginning of A Cemetery Man and the beginning of the Dylan Dog film, the beginning of Cemetery Man, he hears a knock at the door, he opens the door, and he shoots a zombie in the head in less than the first minute of that film. The Brendan Routh film takes 10 minutes for anything to happen. And it just, I just stopped after 10 minutes because it was just dragging. I felt like it was half an hour, but only 10 minutes had passed. And I couldn't get into it. Ralph seems like he's playing a frat boy cosplay of Dylan Dog. He's not even dressed like the character.
That's interesting. Like, I think that first scene does a lot to set the stage for this movie's about. It sort of casually kills the zombie. And then the way he talks on the phone, it really sets the tone. So I can't imagine this movie without a similar scene in it. And that's a great segue because the next question I have for you guys is, should they remake this movie? I mean, it's been 30 years, so enough time has passed.
I'm not sure they should have made it in the first place, but they did. And here we are today discussing it.
I think the Italian or the European audience would love to see a good Dylan Dog film. I read some bad reviews of the Brendan Routh film. It wasn't well received there. They didn't capture the feel of the character. But as far as remaking Cemetery Man, I love the low budget aspect of it. I don't think you could do it by throwing money at it.
No, I think you're right. I think it would lose some of its charm. A lot of these, I find with horror movies of this level, these cheap ones, in this case, we said how much it was, $8 million, $2 million? What was the budget on this thing again?
Four.
$4 million, something like that. It was dirt cheap money, essentially, that they have to make hard decisions on how they're going to do certain shots, what kind of effects that work, and the fact they lean into the fact that they did not have the budget for this, you know, glossy movie makes it work. I think you would lose that to go remake it. Because, you know, they come in and want to make it slick, more explosions, an explanation as to why they're inside a snow globe.
Should we talk about The Crow in that same breath?
I have not seen The New Crow yet. For those of our listeners who have not listened to our episode on The Crow, I highly recommend it because I say the phrase, hot topic the movie, way too many times.
Maybe this could be done as some kind of streaming show where they could really expand the fact. You know, they could really expand the separate vignettes into making them their own episodes, like having a whole episode of just about the zombies, one just about the massacre, one just about the fact that the girl keeps coming back. That could work, maybe.
Or maybe lean into the fact that it was a strip comic, like, you know, do just that little vignette would be an episode.
Yeah.
And then every episode just effectively resets because, you know, there was no continuity between them. There was no like meta behind it. From what I understand, I've never read the books, of course.
The only sad part was, what would be if they did remake this, there wouldn't be as much boob.
No, and you could not get those number one rated perfect boobs come back after all. And really, would you want to see those number one rated perfect boobs at 52?
And Anna Felci also has very deep regard for this film. She loves this film. Anna, who plays she?
Oh, wow. Yeah, everybody who played in this movie. You can look back at articles they've written about or articles they've been involved in. They all love it, right? And again, I want to be very clear, and very, very clear. This movie may not have done well in the U.S., But it had an audience. It had an audience, and it continues to have an audience. And all you got to do, in case anybody's wondering, is go to your Reddit, go to your Quora, go to any one of your sites and type this movie in. And you will find even IMDb gives this a 7, which is, you know, considering where Joker came in, I'd consider that to be a win. The new Joker 2, by the way.
Woo.
Yeah, well, anything 7 and above on IMDb is simply a good sign. Well, like I said, it's a cult movie. The people who love it, it's like people who love watching the Army of Darkness. They'll watch it over and over and over again, or Evil Dead 2. They'll watch it over and over again. I was one of those people.
Army of Darkness.
So would you guys recommend people go, our listeners, go seek this movie out? Go find this movie and go watch it.
Only on copious amounts of some drug to allow you to truly enjoy what you're going to ride.
I could only recommend this to people who have already have a gateway into this type of movie. Like you said, if you like Evil Dead 2, you might like this. But I wouldn't say go from this to Evil Dead 2. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you gotta reverse
that. You gotta have a foothold in those kind of crazy kind of black comedy films before you jump into something like this.
Agreed.
Yeah, this is kind of like expert level on the skill tree of craziness.
Jeremy would have been perfect in this particular area.
So I would say, if you like horror movies, if you like low budget horror movies from that era, from the 80s and 90s, I'm not talking ones like now, you probably should go find this movie. It probably is right in your wheelhouse. But if you are, I like watching G.I. Joe and Transformers, no, don't go find this movie. It is not going to be your flavor.
I love G.I. Joe and Transformers, and I'm flavorful. I took some flavor from this movie.
We can tell you don't want to see it again. So guys, before we're done for the day, how would you rate this movie?
I'm going to give it a 10 for tits. I'm going to give it a 10 for having to slow your day down. I'm going to give it a 5 for what the hell was I watching? And I'm going to give it a 2 for special effects, but add an extra 6 because it does some crazy shit in my mind. That's the movie, folks. That's the exact film.
How does that translate into thumbs?
That isn't a thumb. So that's the problem. It's all in your mind. It's a snow globe. It's not even a thumb. This is exactly what I'm talking about.
I would say I'd give this a thumbs up to guys that are into cheap horror. I'd give it a thumbs up for women who like to see romance, because it does have romance. You've got this guy pining for this girl, and it's an eternal love of his life, and she keeps showing up, and they do hook up eventually. I give it a 5 for coherence, for making sense, but I give it a 9 for just drop some kind of substance and just go with the flow. Just follow it around, let it take you where it wants to take you, and just drink.
That makes sense. I would say if you like the idea of American Psycho, Donnie Darko, Army of Darkness, put into your ninja blender and left there for about 30 minutes, and you came back to it, if you like the sound of that, go see this movie. It's probably a good thumbs up for you. If, on the other hand, you say to yourself, I do not like one or two of those movies, it's probably not going to be your speed. So before we head out, though, I do want to go over a quick mailbag for you. And I want to get your reaction to it.
Ooh,
okay. Now, this one comes mailbag to us after our Atomic Blonde episode. And James, you can chime in on this, too, as if you want to.
I enjoyed that episode.
Oh, good. So this comes in after our Atomic Blonde episode. Lori has a lot of personality. Her voice goes right through the traffic noises. I'm being passed by a loud trailer right now. I can't hear Jeremy, but I can sure hear what she says. That is our review.
I will say Lori is amazingly gifted at ensuring her voice is heard through all levels of traffic. Thank God for that, because it's like my wife.
We've never had a review that relates us to the traffic noises of who they're driving around. So I will take that as a win for us. Except Jeremy, we got to increase the gain on your mic because obviously the truck drowns you out.
If I could give a review of that episode, I found her kind of frightening because she's so enthusiastic about the fighting. And I think she mentioned at one point that she was into martial arts as well. So
she's a black belt in 3 forms of martial arts. So yeah,
I would not want to get on her bad side.
She's a very small Ronda Rousey. I'm going to throw this out there for those who are old enough to enjoy this show. She's a very small Ronda Rousey. She's one of those like ladies that was from the old school. Ronda Rousey, not the lady that's the kickboxer in the new movies, but the old school, the one who's Ronda Rothnick. I knew I was going to say her name correct. Rothnick. You know what I'm talking about. The little short lady with the blonde hair who just kicked everybody's ass in the 90s.
Cynthia Rothrock.
Cynthia Rockrock. Yeah, she's a very small Cynthia Rockrock. I would not want to see her. Yeah, she'll whoop your ass.
So, James, I want to thank you for being with us today again. So, where can people find you?
You can find me at jamesbabo.com, where I usually post about the conventions that I've done and the books that I have coming out. You can also follow me on Facebook, James Babo, Instagram, same. And I usually post news of upcoming releases. And Moses Militia and The Punchliner will be continuing. And I have something new in the works that is horror, but I can't say anything about it yet until I actually find a publisher. And I hope to soon.
Thanks, James. And we will make sure all those links are in the show notes for the episode. On top of that, if any of our listeners want to find any information on our guests, we now have a tab for that on our website, movie-smash.com, where you can find any of the guests that have joined us over the years. And Fergal, where can people find you?
You can always find me at Get Your Nerd On, Gotham Knight Comics on Facebook page. You can find us on IG at Get Your Nerd On. And really, at this point, you can find me on the dopest movie commentary show that is online, called moviesmash.com. And obviously, we're just out here making magic. That's all I can say. It's a magical thing.
So for me, you can always find me over at All Panel Creations, where I'm always over there building some piece of nerdy furniture. I want to thank you, our listeners, for spending some time with us today. And if you have any thoughts on why Cemetery Man is your favorite horror movie and it's better than anything else that's out there right now, just send us a note at movie-smash.com, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. This has been Movie Smash with Chris Roberts, Jeremy Parmentier, and Fergal Amayo. Produced by me, Chris Roberts. Executive produced by Off Panel Creations, LLC. Movie clips provided by the respective studios. You can rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You might even find your review read on a future episode. Got a question for us? Visit us at movie-smash.com and send us a note. It too can be read on a future episode. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Movie Smash wherever you listen to your podcasts. Am I telling the truth or not? We'll never know, Fergal. I'm just trying to ruin your day.